Books on Tape presents The Age of Gold by H.W. Brands, read by Grover Gardner. Prologue: The Baron and the Carpenter. Coloma, January 1848. In the wilderness, a man may do. Given any choice in the matter, James Marshall wouldn't have retained Jenny Wimmer as cook and housekeeper for his construction gang. She was stubborn, surly, belligerently unimaginative in the kitchen, and fully aware she couldn't be replaced. She cooked what she wanted, when she wanted. She served the best portions to her husband, Peter, and their seven children. The hired hands, who bunked in the opposite end of the double log cabin that sheltered the Wimmers, were left with the toughest beef, the stringiest mutton, the stalest peas, the driest biscuits, and without the pumpkin and apple pies that varied ever so slightly the monotonous diet. Meals were served at Jenny's whim, yet she grew furious if the men weren't seated and ready when she deigned to deliver the food. The men chafed under her arbitrary rule during the late autumn of 1847. Their annoyance reached rebellion on Christmas Day, when Marshall happened to be down the river at Sutter's Fort. Most of the men were Mormons, devout Christians after their latter-day fashion, and they desired to savor their holiday and honor their Lord's birth by grooming themselves more fastidiously than the normal work schedule allowed. But Jenny Wimmer would brook no change from her routine. She rang the bell, and when they didn't appear at once, she vowed they could feed themselves. Henry Bigler was an elder of the Mormon Church and a military veteran. He had survived the anti-Mormon pogroms in Missouri and Illinois and fought Mexicans in the war not quite officially ended. He had suffered Jenny Wimmer, till now. "On Christmas morning, just at daylight, we was called to breakfast," he recorded. "We was washing our faces. We was called the second time before we was ready to obey. She told us plainly that she was boss and that we must come at the first call, which we had always had done before. This we did not like, and we revolted from under her government." Marshall returned from the fort to discover the rebellion. As insurrections went, it wasn't much. The Mormons simply insisted that they could no longer abide Jenny Wimmer's arbitrary rule. They must be allowed to build their own living quarters, where they could cook their own meals. Marshall was reluctant to grant the demand, for every hour devoted to building the new cabin would be an hour stolen from building the sawmill, which was the reason they were all wintering at this remote site, 40 miles from Sutter's settlement and many times that distance from anything that could be called civilization. But the Mormons were as irreplaceable as Jenny Wimmer. They intended to stay only till spring, when they would trek east across the mountains to join their fellow saints on the shores of the Great Salt Lake. Marshall could see no alternative. The Mormons must have their own cabin. He set aside the materials, they provided the labor, while Jenny Wimmer looked on with a mixture of disgust and good riddance. After a week's hard work, the cabin was ready. 19-year-old Azariah Smith, one of Bigler's fellow insurgents, noted with satisfaction in his diary, "Last Sunday we moved into it in order to get rid of the brawling partial mistress and cook for ourselves." John Sutter, Marshall's partner, felt much the same way about Marshall that Marshall felt about Jenny Wimmer. In Sutter's home of Switzerland, where tapping the power of falling water was an ancient art, Marshall never would have qualified as a millwright. He had built no mills nor apprenticed to anyone who had. His training, such as it was in carpentry, which was not irrelevant to the construction of the shed and platform that would house and support the millworks, but lacked the elements of smithing, of fabricating iron gears and levers and steel saw blades, that distinguished the craft of genuine millwrights from the make-do approximations of amateurs. Marshall inspired even less confidence as a business partner. He had the uncertain, backward-glancing air of a man who had been haunted by misfortune and was reasonably sure it was still on his trail. His business acumen was demonstrably deficient, his most recent failure being the loss of a ranch in the Sacramento Valley not far from Sutter's own. But Sutter needed a sawmill and couldn't build it himself. New Helvetia was thriving a decade after Sutter had persuaded the governor of California to award him a tract of land on the northern frontier of that Mexican province as a way of forestalling settlement by encroaching Americans, whose proximity was already reflected in the name of a principal tributary to the Sacramento, Rio de los Americanos. Sutter selected a site at the confluence of the two streams, on the east bank of the Sacramento and the south bank of the American. The site was 50 river miles from the nearest arm of the San Francisco Bay and 200 miles by river, bay, and ocean from Monterey, the provincial capital. Sutter hired Indians, including some whose families had first gathered around the Catholic missions in the days of the Spanish. Although the natives required stern guidance, supplied by soldiers Sutter employed, they worked cheaply, which was why they required such stern guidance. In time, they dug irrigation ditches and planted fields, vineyards, and orchards. New Helvetia didn't look much like its namesake, for beyond the reach of Sutter's acequias, the broad flanks of the Sacramento Valley were parched and brown through summers unthinkably hot by alpine standards. But it was his, and for a man whose career had taken him from Baden and Bern to New York, Missouri, New Mexico, Oregon, Hawaii, and Alaska before he finally reached California in 1839, it felt increasingly like home. The sawmill was part of the latest stage of Sutter's expansion, a stage that also included construction of a grist mill. The latter would be located in the valley, near the fort and its fields of grain. Employing the power of gravity, as delivered by the waters of the American River, it would grind Sutter's wheat for his own use and for sale down the Sacramento. For a fee, it would grind the wheat of Sutter's neighbors. The sawmill would be located up the American River, near the trees that would supply the timber the mill would saw into beams and boards. The cut lumber would be carted west to the fort for use there. What Sutter didn't need, he would raft down the Sacramento to the village of Yerba Buena, or San Francisco, as some of the inhabitants had lately started calling it, on a sheltered cove on the inland side of the peninsula south of the entrance to San Francisco Bay. Sutter was a soldier by training, albeit less training than he let on. He said he had reached the rank of captain in the Swiss Army. This wasn't true. He never got further than first under-lieutenant of reserves. But he looked the soldier's part. He carried himself erect in a military manner. His blonde hair curled above his ears and across the crest of his broad forehead, giving him the appearance of a Teutonic Napoleon. He kept his side whiskers and mustache, neatly trimmed, imperial fashion. His eyebrows arched quizzically above his clear blue eyes, as if to inquire whether an order had been carried out with sufficient alacrity. The pose worked. The governor of California commissioned Sutter a captain of militia to guard against the Americans and other foreigners. Sutter was also appointed alcalde, thereby receiving powers akin to those of an American mayor and sheriff combined. He liked the authority and the titles. When the more obsequious of those requesting his favor called him general, he didn't correct them. For a man who had fled Switzerland just ahead of the debt police, leaving behind a wife and children, he could congratulate himself on doing well, remarkably well. Looking out from his headquarters in the fort he named for himself, he was lord of all he surveyed. Yet the lord slept uneasily some nights. His fitfulness traced to the March day in 1844, when an American military officer unexpectedly appeared from out of the snowdrifts of the Sierras at the head of a mounted column. Sutter knew enough about Americans to know they collectively possessed an annoying self-confidence, a smug certitude that God smiled more brightly on them than on any other portion of humanity. But he had never met anyone as infuriatingly self-assured as John Fremont. The American captain had conquered the mountains to reach California, no mean midwinter's feat, Sutter had to admit, and he acted as if he could conquer anything or anyone in the valley below. On that 1844 visit, Fremont had contented himself with registering disdain for Mexican authority, parading about the province as he pleased, leaving only when he saw fit. But he returned in December 1845, and his second coming heralded the war that even now seemed likely to wrest California from Mexico and deliver it to the United States, in apparent fulfillment of the plan the Americans ascribed to Providence. Against Fremont's...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?